This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there. I hope you're having a terrific day. I'm Joel Hilliker. Are we about to see war between Russia and Europe? Vladimir Putin is really putting the pressure on Europe. He's cutting off European energy supplies. He's supporting Belarusian migrants streaming into Poland. He's possibly preparing to attack Ukraine, among other things. How will Europe respond? This is the million-dollar question, and we'll hear about it from Trumpet writer Richard Palmer in our first segment. Then the FBI recently raided the home of an American who attended the January 6th protest in Washington, D.C. They were looking for something he didn't have, but they ended up grabbing a pocket copy of the U.S. Constitution to use as evidence against him. What does it say when the founding document of the country is considered evidence of right-wing extremism? We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal pointing to some very interesting ancient history that sheds light on this alarming trend. Do you struggle with weight? A lot of people do, but there's a lot of bad, even deceitful advice out there. Now, some of them might help you lose weight temporarily, but then gain it right back or even cause long-term damage to your body. How can you lose weight the right way for the long term? We'll have a conversation with personal trainer and holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian about this. And for the last word on today's show, I'll talk about something dangerous you're probably carrying around in your life that I want to encourage you to get rid of. Let's start by looking at the tensions rising between Russia and Europe in this report from Richard Palmer.
Over the summer, Europe received a massive wake-up call about its vulnerability and need for leadership. Now, just in case they hit snooze, they're receiving that wake-up call all over again. Right now, Russian President Vladimir Putin is really piling the pressure on Europe. He's causing a gas shortage, he's massing troops on their borders. Just last week, US officials have been warning their European counterparts that Russia might be about to attack Ukraine. Russian nuclear bombers have even been patrolling Belarus's borders with Poland. Perhaps most provocatively, Putin is deliberately creating a migrant crisis for Europe. Thousands of migrants are crossing into Poland and Lithuania, who are becoming overwhelmed and threatening to escalate the crisis militarily. Belarus is flying people in from the Middle East and then pushing them across the border. Belarus is a Russian satellite. Everyone knows they would not be acting in this way without the express permission of Russia and with Putin. There are even reports that Belarus is arming these migrants that they're sending over, giving them things like stun grenades so that they can attack the Polish border forces and make it into Poland. The situation is quickly escalating into a bit of a standoff where Belarus brings these migrants in. They want to make them as desperate as possible. They want to make the situation as bad as possible to put pressure on Poland to take them in. So they're not feeding them. They're housing them. They're forcibly shoving them over the border. While Poland doesn't want to let thousands of people just cross into their territory. So they're just shoving them right back. And it's creating a massive migrant crisis where Europe has never traditionally had a problem with migrants. Poland is quite famously not close to the Middle East. So Poland is supplementing its border guards with thousands of soldiers. And then on the other side, you've got the Belarusian military backed by Russia, ready for battle. And this is not the only front. Putin is threatening Europe in the Balkans. Serbs in Bosnia are threatening to split off and claiming that they have Russia's backing for their action. And anytime anyone threatens to break up a country in the Balkans, it makes a whole lot of people nervous. If Bosnia Serbs did split off, they could rejoin Serbia itself. And potentially strengthen the pro-Russian forces in the region, creating some kind of greater Serbia that may well then look at trying to split off other Serbian parts from other countries to bring back the parts of Serbia that were forcibly taken away from it in the early 1990s. It was only 30 years ago that the Balkans was Europe's biggest war. And the EU has been consolidating its hold over the area. The last thing they want is more conflict, or even worse, some kind of Greater Serbia as a strong ally of Russia in the region. And then Putin is really beefing up this energy crisis. Gas prices in Europe have gone up 650% this year. And yes, you heard that they're up 6.5 times. Energy companies are going bust left, right, and center as they can't keep up with these high prices and supplying gas and electricity at the prices they've promised. Putin has closed one gas pipeline, cut the amount that's sent through another in half. He's sitting on the sidelines saying, well, shame about that gas crisis you seem to be experiencing. You know, I've got an awful lot of natural gas. I could help you out with that if you do what I want. If you approve this new pipeline that I've built and bypass the law on that. Now, this is not a series of coincidences. Putin is very deliberately menacing Europe at this time, and every day it escalates. Why? Well, I honestly don't know exactly. You know, he could be about to try something big. It could all revolve around the Nord Stream pipeline, and he may be just really pressuring Europe to accept Russian gas so that he's got them under their thumb for the future. Maybe he's prepping for some kind of bigger action, sending a message, I'm about to invade somewhere, and if you interfere, I'll cut off your gas, I'll wreck your economies, I'll blow up the Balkans, and I'll flood your countries with migrants, so stay out of my way. I don't know exactly, but I want to focus on something we do know about. How this is going to affect Europe. This is something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry really focused on in his latest Trumpet print edition. In that article, he talked about how America has power but lacks the will to use it. As a result, he wrote, Europe is growing anxious over its own leadership vacuum. That there is a real recognition in Europe of their need for military unity. The trouble is they lack the robust leadership needed to bring it about. Analysts say Europe is up for grabs. The dust hasn't even settled on the Afghanistan crisis. Its effects are still reverberating around the world. And now we have another crisis that for Europe is doing exactly the same thing. Thus far, Europe has responded to Russian aggression, mostly in the form of sanctions against Belarus. Very little been done against Russia or Putin. Europe's response is weak, and everyone knows it. And a lot of people in Europe see that it is weak. And they see that in this situation, Vladimir Putin appears to hold just about all of their cards. Without America behind them, without a strong America that's going to stand up to these kind of threats, what can Europe do by themselves? Just like as within Afghanistan, the answer is not much. Europe knows America hasn't got their back. Putin knows America won't stop him. He can do pretty much whatever he likes. It's the same lesson as Afghanistan. In a world without America, Europe needs to make big changes. And we're starting to see some of those changes begin. Just a few weeks ago, Poland was on the brink of quitting the EU, it seemed like. The European Court of Justice issued a fine where they would have to pay millions of euros a day. Poland was promising to defy the fine and refused to pay it. And now the whole kerfuffle has been forgotten. The American Spectator pointed out the other day that most of the illegals would head for Germany and France to take up their social welfare systems, which of course the EU fears. Now suddenly Polish President Andrzej Duda and his government are the heroes of the EU. You know, Russia and Germany, now they're right behind Poland. The EU's even looking at giving Poland more money so that Poland can build better border walls. But at the same time, Poland knows that they can't stand up to Russia alone. They would prefer to have the United States as a close ally, but if they can't rely on America, they need Europe. And so they're toning down some of their rhetoric and action too. The row isn't over and it will probably resurface again if things calm down. But for now, it has all been forgotten as fear of Russia pushes these European countries together, which is exactly what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has focused on when it comes to Europe and Russian relations. He wrote all the way back after Russia invaded Crimea that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimean crisis, back when Russia invaded Crimea. This prophecy is directly related to Russian aggression. He said that the fear that you see in Europe, Because of all of these things Russia is doing, it's going to cause 10 leaders of Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of a European empire. You know, we see this happening. Mr. Florio wrote that the reaction within Europe to this crisis is something you need to watch because it is shaping and molding the future composition of the Holy Roman Empire. It is making European leaders move urgently to tie together this Holy Roman Empire that we've been prophesying about for so many years. That's exactly what we see with this latest outbreak of crisis. And he went on to talk about a second major prophecy that Russia is forcing to happen in Europe. And he said that Russia's actions will bring about the arrival of a strong man in Europe. A new leader is coming, a kind of Vladimir Putin. That is what Europe needs in order to bind together, to have this strength and unity of purpose needed to confront Russia. That is what people are seeing more and more in Europe. You look at Russia on paper. Its economy is much smaller than Germany's. You look at Europe's combined military spending, and they should be far more powerful than Russia. But Russia is united, and Russia has a strong leader. Europe is divided and devoid of leadership. That is crucial. That makes all the difference, and European leaders are seeing that. They can see Russia, and they can see, if we had a Putin, imagine what we could be. And without a Putin, well, we're just breakfast for Russia. Mr. Florio wrote in this article, Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy. The growing necessity to protect themselves is going to drive European leaders to pare down the number of nations in their union and empower a strongman. He wrote that Putin is helping to create a power that is going to be greater than his own. He doesn't know that because he doesn't understand Bible prophecy, but he is going to know it. And the clash between these two powers will cause more suffering than the world has ever known. Europe is really getting its face rubbed in this lesson that it needs leadership. The arrival of that leadership is just absolutely pivotal in the fulfillment of end time events. Daniel chapter 11, Daniel chapter 8 talk about this leader and the role that he plays in end time Bible prophecy. He plays a key role in these events, but he plays a key role leading to good news as well. It's all happening according to God's plan, and it is going to culminate in the return of Jesus Christ. So that's why we need to watch closely what is happening in Europe, what is happening in this confrontation, and what is happening with the arrival of this strongman.
Thank you very much for that, Richard. Your point about how Russia's actions are suddenly causing Poland and the rest of Europe to set aside their differences and make common cause, it really is a profound development. This is exactly what we can expect to see writ large in the time ahead. Europe responding to global threats by pulling together, despite what prophecy says is always going to be an unwieldy combination of iron and clay in Europe.
Yeah, I think it's just a fascinating dynamic that does so much to show that this prophecy, when you get into some of these details, it really shows that this doesn't come from a human mind, that you've got these prophecies thousands of years ago. And then, when Mr. Armstrong when God was revealing these prophecies to him back all the way back in the 30s, but certainly the 50s, the 60s, while Europe was coming together, there's just so much accuracy to what he said. You had a lot of European federalists that were talking about how we're going to get together and this union is going to be great and it's going to be so easy and it's going to be awesome. And Mr. Armstrong was there saying, well, it's going to happen. The Bible says that it's going to happen. But the kind of frictions that we've seen for all of those decades, he also said that that's going to happen too. He said that these countries are going to struggle to get along, that you'll see different people compete to be who's in charge of the union and then butt heads and them have failures and things like that. Which is exactly what we've seen. It's just such a detailed picture that God revealed from the Bible about what's happening. And then the way you see this dynamic where they're falling out and then Russia comes and pushes them together, squeezes this kind of, the Bible talks about it as being iron and clay, that that's not going to come together unless something outside forces it. Iron and clay don't mix. And that's exactly the kind of dynamic you have in Europe.
Yeah, these politicians that are finding common cause in light of what Russia is doing, like you said, it's just absolutely perfect, crystal clear picture painted in that prophecy in Daniel 2. And the way that it's described in that prophecy, it doesn't last long. In fact, as powerful as it becomes, it's really only on the world stage for a few years before the whole thing falls apart, outside pressures, and then the conflict between that European empire and the kings of the East, of which Russia is the predominant power, bring it to a swift end. So watching what's happening in Europe and just seeing these dynamics and the friction that you're describing playing out in reality really is extraordinary when you understand these prophecies.
It's almost like we're getting a preview of how some of these prophecies will play out. You know, you're getting the same dynamic with Russia and China, you know, conflict between Europe and Russia. And like you said, you know, that's just something that's going to get so much worse. So, yeah, interesting to watch.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about Russia's provocations causing Europe to pull together. He's working on an article about this. I believe this should go out as the Trumpet Brief today. You can watch for that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Richard. This is really a situation that we need to keep our eyes on. We appreciate you just bringing us up to speed on the very latest of what's happening there.
Great to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In the United States today, cherishing the Constitution marks you as an extremist, according to the current government. This shocking state of affairs has an interesting parallel in ancient history, as we will now learn in this report from Brent Noctegal.
Where the Book of the Covenant was found in the possession of anyone, or if anyone adhered to the law, the decree of the king condemned him to death. 1 Maccabees 1:57. This ancient passage of text from 2,000 years ago has been rattling around in my brain for the past 2 days. Let me tell you why. It has everything to do with what's happening in the United States of America. On Saturday night, I watched Tucker Carlson's much-forbidden 3-part documentary on the events of January 6 and its aftermath. The one scene that particularly stood out to me was when gun-wielding Federal Bureau of Investigation agents invaded the home of Paul and Marilyn Hooper, a middle-aged Alaskan couple from the small town of Homer. Their crime? Attending the January 6 Save America Trump rally. The FBI thought Mrs. Hooper had stolen Nancy Pelosi's laptop, but in actual fact, the couple didn't even enter the Capitol that day. However, it wasn't the fact that the FBI invaded their home that got my attention. It was which of the Hoopers' personal items the FBI seized, presumably to be used as evidence that they were conspirators against the state. After cuffing and questioning the couple, an FBI agent took Mrs. Hooper's laptop and something else. Something you might have in your home too. Quote, "And then he took a little tiny copy of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution," end quote, Mrs. Hooper said on episode 2 of Carlson's documentary. Her husband then chimed in, quote, "This is how the government sees you. They seized my copy of the Declaration of Independence and Constitution as evidence against me. What does that say?" End quote. That is a good question. The answer provides a moment of clarity about the course the Biden administration is taking America in its self-proclaimed war against domestic terrorists. Here is a United States federal agency engaged in a pre-dawn raid of attendees of a political rally, and part of the confiscated evidence is a personal copy of the foundational law of the United States. As Mr. Hooper told Carlson, quote, "If you have a copy of those rights, you are considered to be an extreme radical today," end quote. With that in mind, now consider the quote again from the Book of Maccabees. Quote, "Where the Book of the Covenant was found in the possession of anyone, or if anyone adhered to the law, the decree of the king condemned him to death." Now the Hoopers were not condemned to death for possessing a copy of the Constitution. Nonetheless, Mr. Hooper's question needs to be answered. What does it say of the motives of the Biden administration if its agents are going around seizing personal copies of America's foundational Book of the Covenant? To answer that, it's worth exploring the ancient parallel, especially considering the Bible prophesies specifically that the ancient type would play out again in this end time. The first book of Maccabees is an eyewitness account. It's an accurate historical telling. It describes the events of the early 2nd century, about 300 years after the Old Testament ends and 200 years before the New Testament begins. And yet, the Bible itself is not silent on these events. The aged prophet Daniel recorded a vision from God shortly before he died that prophesied what was to befall the people of Israel both in the years following Daniel's death and also in the last days, our days today. The account recorded in Daniel 11 contains the most accurate telling of provable historical events of the 300 years following Daniel's death, but it's also mainly for our time again today. In Daniel 11 verse 21, the account slows down and focuses on the work of a singular individual, a vile, despicable, and monstrous person that history knows as Antiochus IV. King Antiochus was narcissist in chief, calling himself Epiphanes, meaning God manifest. He ruled over the Seleucid Empire, which, during the time of his rule, comprised the territory of modern-day Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and crucially, Judea, or Israel today. Antiochus Epiphanes is also the chief antagonist, the king, in that history of the Maccabees, the quote that I read before. The Maccabees were the Jews who revolted against Antiochus' decrees. Both Daniel and 1 Maccabees detail the events of Antiochus' actions against the Jewish people, Daniel as prophecy, and the Maccabees as history. Now, crucially, both accounts tell of the inexplicable wrath Antiochus inflicted upon the Jews. His campaign was not just about trying to control a subject population, which the Jews were. It wasn't enough for Antiochus to attempt to destroy the Jewish people. He actually sought to destroy every vestige of the law he could find as well. He sought to blot out the constitution of the Jews. Again, quote, where the Book of the Covenant was found in the possession of anyone, or if anyone adhered to the law, the decree of the king, King Antiochus, condemned him to death. The Book of the Covenant, in this historical case, were the foundational books of the Bible. They were looked upon by many of the Jews as holding the weight of constitutional law. Clearly, Antiochus's hatred was not just against a group of people, but against their foundational law, the very source of the Jewish people's identity. Mr. Flurry wrote about Antiochus in his article in 2014, What Inspires President Obama's Relationship with Israel. He said this, quote, for Antiochus, it wasn't enough to kill tens of thousands of Jews. He tried to kill their religion, end quote. Now, without being able to practice the law or even keep a copy of the law, the Jewish people would have likely melted into history like other ancient people. Thankfully, history bears out that Antiochus was unsuccessful. In fact, it was zeal for upholding the law that motivated the Maccabean revolt against Antiochus. Let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me, said Mattathias, the father of the rebellion that would bring Antiochus's downfall from Judea. Yet, Antiochus's strategy was clear. By blotting out the constitution, Antiochus sought to blot out the Jewish people. Now consider again what Mr. Hooper told Tucker Carlson. They seized my copy of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution as evidenced against me. What does that say? End quote. Again, what does it say about the spirit behind this administration that seeks to undermine the foundational law of the nation? It used to be that judges, whether originalists or those who favored a more liberal interpretation, argued over the nature of the Constitution. But now America's leaders want to blot out the Constitution altogether. It used to be that card-carrying communists were deemed enemies of the state. Now it's those who carry a copy of the Constitution. It is true that the U.S. Constitution is not the law of God, although much of it is founded on biblical values. Yet the Constitution is the foundational law that preserves the unity of the United States. This same hatred towards the Constitution was on display throughout the administration of Barack Obama. One highly illustrative example is when the Obama administration's Internal Revenue Service was exposed as targeting Tea Party organizations and other groups. As the Inspector General's report revealed, some of these other groups included, quote, political action type organizations involved in educating on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, end quote. Commenting on the Inspector General's report at the time, Georgetown professor Nicholas Quinn Rosenkrantz wrote this, quote, federal officers swear an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, end quote. It's chilling, he writes, to think that these same individuals who are suspicious of the Tea Party are equally suspicious of the Constitution itself. This is a new low for American government, targeting those who would teach others about its founding document. In short, he writes, never before has the federal government singled out for special scrutiny those who would teach their fellow citizens about our magnificent Constitution. This is the new innovation of Obama's IRS, end quote. Now, clearly, what started as a directive by Obama's IRS to target those who dare educate Americans about the Constitution is getting more personal today. Now, a personal copy of the U.S. Constitution in your home is evidence that you are an enemy of the state. Now, where does this hatred for the Constitution originate? Could it be that the same spirit that motivated Antiochus Epiphanes to attack anyone who had a copy of the law is at work inside the United States today? As Mr. Flurry wrote, Antiochus didn't come up with the idea himself. Anytime a person like Antiochus is involved, it's more than just Antiochus that you're dealing with. There is a God-hating, evil spirit power at work, end quote. After 2,000 years, Antiochus's face might have changed, but the strategy and the spirit remain the same. These parallels between what happened to the Jews 2,000 years ago and what is taking place today in the United States, they're worth considering. The Bible said this would happen. To understand why, please request Gerald Flurry's free book, America Under Attack.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, has been pointing to this history about Antiochus Epiphanes for years, and it's becoming more and more relevant with what you see happening in the government today, more obvious. You've studied quite a lot about that history, and when this decree went out anciently, how did the Jews respond to that?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting because it was kind of slow at first. Antiochus Epiphanes, his interaction with the Jews, at first it was kind of a creeping towards Hellenism, basically accepting Greek customs and a Greek way of life in Jerusalem that was accepted by the upper echelon of society. However, it was only towards the latter campaigns that Antiochus had down into Egypt that he really got furious and angry towards the Jews and decided to forcefully Hellenize the whole country to the point that there was no longer allowed to be a copy of the law. And what the Maccabees relates, which is, as I brought out in that report, really a historical account written by an eyewitness, somebody was there at the time, at least the first book of Maccabees there. What that shows is that pretty much everybody in Judea, especially in Jerusalem along the ruling class, had been willing to go along or at least not fight back against Antiochus's rulings. The way that the Maccabean revolt started was really on the edge of Judea, this province that was underneath the control of King Antiochus Epiphanes, with a faithful family that we know today as the Maccabean family or the Hasmoneans, and they would basically you know, when the king came to enforce the apostasy, as it says, in their hometown of Modin, he stood up and said, you know, we're not going to stand for it. If you're zealous for the law, we're going to come and fight this. We're not going to give up our traditions. We're not going to give up our law. And so 3 years later is when you, after about 3 years of fighting, they successfully ridded the temple of Antiochus's men. They successfully then started a campaign against removing Antiochus's forces from all of Judea. That would take another 20 years or so. However, what's interesting about the account in the Maccabees is that a lot of people had been going along with the changes that Antiochus was forcing upon the Jews, and they weren't willing really to fight back. However, I'm not to say that everyone that was in Jerusalem or whatever was happy with the changes. However, it really did take a family from the outskirts of the province to make the substantial change that would end up, you know, as Daniel says, those that would rise up and be strong and do exploits. So that it is a really interesting factor that you had the upper level of Judean society that were inviting Hellenism into the capital far before Antiochus Epiphanes even came along, and he really pushed it along to the greatest degree. And then at some point, it's like Antiochus Epiphanes really snapped, and he decided that this was going to be an entire, not just ethnic cleansing of the Jewish people, but religious or a cleansing of their holy books as well.
So the more that you understand about that history, the more you see the parallels with what's happening today?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly that's the case, especially, you know, in the United States. There are some differences, of course. Back then, you did have, this was an outside leader that was kind of forcing what he wanted upon the Jewish people, and some went along with it and some didn't. However, what you have is the leadership of the United States itself, in the Obama administration, now the Biden administration, really forcing a massive cultural change upon the nation, and to the point that they undermine, malign the very founding documents of the United States as well. I mean, it was bizarre for me to watch that program and to see these people that had their homes raided talk about how the fact that they have a pocketbook constitution and Declaration of Independence, and that was taken as evidence against them. That's shocking to me. But then again, I was just with my head in this history. We're coming up to Hanukkah. Everyone knows about that. That's also about the Maccabean period. With my head in this history, it was just like, whoa, they're really, if you've got a copy of that law now, you make yourself a prey, you make yourself a target, you're showing yourself to be on the other side of the regime in power. And that's what it was like during Antiochus's day. You've got a copy of the law, you better watch out. You better watch out, because Antiochus is coming for you. And that has begun in the United States with some of these pretty big changes and against the Constitution, not just against the understanding of the Constitution, but the document itself.
Well, we appreciate that very much, Brent. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall about Antiochus Epiphanes and his assault on the Jews by criminalizing their founding documents and the parallels with what is happening in America today. He wrote about this in the Trumpet Brief that went out on Monday. It's up at thetrumpet.com. The title of the article, Constitution Carrying Citizens Beware. Go check it out. Thanks so much, Brent.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
A lot of people want to lose weight, and there are almost as many plans and programs and pieces of advice for how to do it. Sadly, a lot of that is bad, even deceitful. Some of it might help you lose weight temporarily, but you'll gain it right back or even cause long-term damage to your body. How can you lose weight the right way for the long term? To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, holistic nutritionist and personal trainer Jörg Mardian. Hello, Jörg.
Hi there.
So you have worked with a lot of clients on this very issue. What's the biggest thing that people who are trying to lose weight get wrong?
Right. Well, there's a lot of trendy diets out there. We know that. And there's a lot of gimmicks and unhealthy recommendations. And we know that more than half of dieters regain the weight that they've lost within 2 years. And the studies have proven that. So perhaps the most important aspect of dietary blunders is the misunderstanding of what food really does to the body, how food connects to emotions, how it makes us feel. And that runs a lot deeper than just counting calories. So healthy food is critical because it provides the energy and the nutrients that represent the raw materials to produce hormones in the body, and that fuels the body. And if we abuse our process with junk food, then or deprivation, then you get into a deep dive, what's called emotional eating. I get a lot of clients that say, look, I'm eating emotionally, and they don't understand what's happening with their body in that process. And that's really the opposite of willpower. It crushes willpower. And, you know, there's reasons for that. So if you're giving into unhealthy cravings, it feels like a weakness. You're giving into a weakness, but it's really much more complex than that because your body's fighting you. So one of the first things that happens is that your refined foods stimulate the brain's reward system with feel-good chemicals. And that includes the neurotransmitter dopamine. I mean, we've talked about dopamine before in different programs. And the brain interprets that as pleasure. All right. So this reward that we get from junk food or refined food is far more powerful than the moderate release of dopamine we get from whole foods. So, you know, for susceptible people, this can act like a full-blown addiction. And not for everybody, but for many. And if you do this repeatedly, it means you get desensitized and you need more of these stimulating foods without getting the same level of reward as before. So that's a process that's called tolerance. And that's it acts the same way. It has the same pathway as drugs, really. So, and that stage, when you're at that stage, it creates huge cravings for unhealthy foods that have very little to do with what you need for the body. You know, your need for energy or your need for nourishment. And for many, when they're at that stage, that kind of thinking can easily override willpower, the willpower that you need to consider the health impacts of eating that junk food. So basically, you want what you want at that moment, and you don't care what it does, the food does. So and the reason that these unhealthy foods cause emotional triggers hinges on the big three ingredients, as you know, sugars, fats, and salts, among many, of course. But those are the big guns. And they really cause a roller coaster of hormonal imbalances in the body. And these fluctuations affect everything from our mood to gut health and even stress levels. So the question is, and that's where people get stuck, how do we regain health and a balanced body weight at that stage when we don't know what we're doing?
Right. Yeah, that's the big question, isn't it? How do you break out of that cycle? And I'm assuming what you're talking about, this kind of addictive nature of these unhealthy foods, is probably the biggest cause of the people who are coming to you and saying, you know, I've tried this, I've tried that, and nothing works. I keep finding myself back at the buffet bar, or, you know, cramming my face with this or that that I promised myself that I wouldn't do. How do you break that cycle? How do you get to a place where you can gain control of what you're putting in your mouth?
Well, in my practice, I use key principles. There's a lot, and usually if a person is you know, greatly overweight, I mean, we go into much more detail, but I'll just list five key principles. And so the first obvious one is to get rid of the food that causes the problems. And that's really the refined foods, the nutrient deficient foods, man-made foods. You know, unfortunately, half of an American foods come from that ultra-processed variety. You know, I think the statistics say 74% of all food items are spiked with added sugar.
75%. I mean,
Yeah, it just causes a big setback because whatever you pick has something bad in it. And there's a lot of other ingredients. And that causes a dangerous rise in blood sugar and insulin. And then leptin, which is your master hormone that normally regulates your body weight, that actually turns on you and causes you to get really hungry. So, and at this point, again, you know, your willpower is going out the window and your body's giving you these powerful, almost overwhelming signals to cave in and eat anything in sight.
Mm-hmm.
So really it has to do with the junk that you're putting into your body as the first principle. The second key principle is the quality of the food you take in. Think about what you're filling your body with. You're never going to go wrong by filling up on whole foods that contain all the nutrients and the phytochemicals and the antioxidants that your body needs. And most of those foods are low in calories. Even better, they boost focus, concentration, and energy. And they fill what's called a nutritional hunger, a real hunger, okay? And they minimize what's called a fake emotional hunger. And that fake emotional hunger is when we just feel hungry and we reach for something, but that's not really the hunger where your stomach is gnawing, you know, when you need food. So foods that fill our nutritional hunger are like vegetables and fruits and healthy meats, nuts, and healthy fats, as we've discussed before. And as I tell my clients, you need smaller amounts of unrefined carbohydrates. And why is that? Because most of us aren't as busy or work as hard as we used to. So carbohydrates can act as a sugar in the body and put on weight. And so that's the food quality principle. The third principle is one of moderation or food quantity. So even if you're eating unprocessed foods, you have to watch your portion sizes. You know, so some foods have more calories than others, like nuts. I get a lot of clients that say, well, I'm eating everything you're telling me, but, and then I say, well, show me. And then they've eaten, you know, handfuls and handfuls of nuts. Well, mm-hmm. That's a lot of calories.
Right.
You know, so we
nothing
should eat
wrong
smaller
with nuts.
Amounts of certain foods.
It's just a matter of portion size.
Portion size, yeah. So, but this part, eating only enough for your body's needs, not beyond it, is one of the biggest overlooked factors in dietary failure. We just eat too much. I tell so many clients, just cut your portions down. Even as a beginning point, you're going to see results.
Mm-hmm.
So fourth one, which many people don't see is obey your thirst. Studies show that 37% of people mistake hunger for thirst. So if you want to figure out whether you're hungry or thirsty, drink some water and wait 15 minutes.
Huh.
Now, if you're hungry, you're still going to feel that stomach pang. But if you're thirsty, you're going to feel satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also opt, there's what's called water-based foods, like fruits and vegetables contain a lot of water, you know, and they satisfy hunger and thirst, and they curb cravings. So, and the fifth one is a big one, journaling. And I use that with great success. There was a huge study of almost 2,000 participants, and they showed that those people who journal lose twice as much weight as those who don't. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us that a journal gives you oversight. It gives you accountability. It keeps you grounded and motivated because you know what you're doing. Simply look at what you've done in the past. What were you eating? How was it prepared? You know, was it prepared in an unhealthy way or a healthy way? How much are you eating and when are you eating? Are you doing late night snacking? And how do you feel after you eat foods? Do you have to cut a food out because it gives you a problem? You know, indigestion or something. You might be sensitive to it. Those are all important points in. And so that's an accountability record. It allows you to go back and correct mistakes. And then after 6 months, I tell my clients, look, take out all the bad days, rip them out, keep only the days that were successful, and then keep repeating that. And then, you know, you're going to have success.
Yeah.
So I've worked with clients for 20 years, and they've lost everything from 20 to up to 160 pounds. Now, the reason that these big points work is because the health laws are obeyed. That's it. You know, basically cut out the junk food and you keep the weight and the body fat levels at a reasonable level, you know, and then that causes a disruption in the cycle of chronic disease and obesity. So you break that cycle by being true to what you're doing, being consistent in what you're doing. And I just talked to somebody yesterday and, you know, he called me back after 2 weeks. I said, look, you're going to need 2 months, 3 months. You've been at it for decades. Keep doing that. Stay honest. Look at what you're doing. You know, be honest with what you're writing down and then change those things. Stay consistent with it and you're going to have great results.
Yeah, that key honesty is really important, isn't it? Because you're talking about, first, on one hand, you're talking about people who are kind of short-circuiting their best intentions because of this kind of emotional response that they're taking to food. On the other hand, you're talking about journaling being such a difference maker where, you know, writing, the act of writing doesn't cause you to lose weight, but there's something about the fact that you're being honest about what you've written down. I mean, I suppose a lot of people, you could write whatever you want in that journal. It's if you're writing honestly and then you're assessing what you're eating and then you're making adjustments based on an honest reflection on what you've put in your body. But that, how much do you find that, say, the person who they say, I've tried this, I've tried that, it's not working, that you have to kind of bring them back to this point of, you've got to be more honest with yourself. You're not really owning up to what you're really putting into your body.
Well, right. I can't always be there for my clients, and I tell them that. I'm here to educate you. So let's do what we know will work for you. So honesty means, look, I know how to do it, but that doesn't work, knowing something. You have to apply what you know. But then you have to understand what you've done as well. So going back into your journal means, look, I've made these mistakes because we forget. I can get people to talk about a diet 2 days ago and they have no idea. They forget all kinds of things. That journal is going to keep you on track. Now, I talk about honesty because you can read it and ignore it. But if you're honest, and I mean brutally honest, then you're going to look at that and say, have I put everything in there that's bad? And am I making the best effort I can to cut out the bad to the best of my ability? And if you do that, then you're going to be on the path to getting your body onto good health and a proper body weight.
Well, it's a fascinating subject. I hope that these five principles that you laid out for us give some good guidance for people who are struggling with this issue. We've been talking with personal trainer and holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian about how to lose weight the right way. And he is working on an article that should appear soon at thetrumpet.com. We'll put those five points in there. And so you can take a little more time to study those and do your best to put them into action with brutal honesty. Thanks so much, Jörg. It's great to have you on as usual.
Great to be here.
It's time for today's last word.
I suggest you get rid of something in your life. It's something most of us carry unwittingly. Even if we recognize it, we justify it. We think it's harmless, but it's not harmless. It's sin, and it wreaks terrible damage in our lives. Getting rid of it isn't easy, but doing so will make your life happier, simpler, and freer of stress. It will invite more of God's blessings, and it'll make you more like God. What am I talking about? I'm talking about your second set of measuring tools. Here is God's law. You can read this in Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 to 14. You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small. In ancient markets, transactions were placed on a scale and measured against standard weights. When a shady merchant would buy from suppliers, he might use a heavy weight to make it appear he was receiving less than he actually was. When he then turned around to sell, he could get out his lighter weights in order to give less than his customer had paid for. You're not an open market vendor, but it is easier to have two different scales of measurement than you may think. You wouldn't steal a television from a retail store, but you might steal time from your employer by slacking off when nobody is looking. You wouldn't rob a bank, but you might not justify reporting certain income on your taxes. You wouldn't have an affair, but you might look at a salacious website. You may not lie about that frivolous purchase at the mall, but you might hide the fact that you cheated on your diet in a moment of weakness. Still, you consider yourself a person of integrity. You do the right thing in the big areas where it really matters, but then you give yourself a pass for fudging occasionally in little areas where the policy doesn't apply to you or it's too small to matter. This won't hurt anyone. No one will know. That's two different measures. Is stealing wrong? Then why would a little bit be okay? Is hatred wrong? Then what makes it acceptable to simply keep it to yourself and pretend you have nothing but love? Why try to justify virtual lust when God says that harboring it in the heart is adultery and it'll burn you just as surely as holding fire near your chest? God says in Luke 16, verse 10, that if you're faithful in that which is least, he can entrust you with greater things. But if you're dishonest in the small areas, your integrity is compromised. God is looking at your character. Your conduct in the little matters tells him all he needs to know about the person you really are. You might have two different scales, one to judge your friends and allies and another to judge your enemies, or one to weigh your own actions and another to weigh other people's. You might use one measure for when you're alone and another for when others are watching. A merchant using falsified measures is being deliberately dishonest. The double standards we tend to hold are subtler, but they're just as dishonest. Every day, many opportunities arise to exercise such deceit, even in very small areas. Track yourself through the day and see if you hold a double standard in certain details, giving yourself permission to think or do things you wouldn't want other people to know about. The basic reason we possess two measures in these subtler forms is that our human nature likes to think of itself as good. We can be astonishingly adept at justifying dishonesty. But if you find two measures, honestly assess why you have them. God wants us to be totally honest. His law says, you shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure. God knows diverse weights and measures when he sees them, and he calls breaking this law an abomination. In 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 8, the Apostle Paul summarized God's way of life with two words, sincerity and truth. Sincerity means purity. The Greek literally means found pure when unfolded and examined by the sun's light. That's what God wants for your life, for you to be able to live in a way that your innermost heart can be unfolded in broad sunlight, scrutinized and found pure. Truth means that which is true and free from error, but it also means truth as a personal virtue, a mind free from pretense, falsehood, deceit. So it's closely linked with the concept of sincerity. The gap between two measures is a form of hypocrisy, proclaiming one standard and living by another. The reality is that it's virtually impossible not to have some hypocrisy if you're trying to uphold godly standards. We all fall short of the ideals we profess. The question is how wholeheartedly we're working to close the gap between profession and action. We shouldn't rest content with any lack of integrity or personal deception or dissonance between what we know to be right and what we do. Our aim must be perfect harmony between the two, living each moment like God is right there watching and measuring. Don't weigh your own goodness by other people's opinions. Don't calculate your righteousness by comparing it with sinners worse than yourself. Don't evaluate your thoughts by a lighter standard than your deeds. Get rid of all your weights and measures and keep the one and only perfect and just measure, God's. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Edmund Burke. It is a general popular error to imagine the loudest complainers for the public to be the most anxious for its welfare. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.